To receive weekly mailings of Rabbi Mansour's tapes or to sponsor a tape, call 718-375-1023. To hear Rabbi Mansour's daily halakha or to search the Rabbi's database of halakhot, visit www.dailyhalakha.com. That's DAILYHALACHA.com. And now, Rav Mansour.
We're studying Parashat Vayakhel. In Parashat Vayakhel, right at the beginning, Moshe Rabbeinu gathers the Jewish people. This happened after the story of the Egel. Last week we read the Egel story, the golden calf. We gave our explanations. After that catastrophe of Klal Yisrael, after the people died and God punished them, Moshe Rabbeinu gathers the Jewish people, Vayakhel Moshe, and he tells them the first law, the law of Shabbat. And the Torah says, Sheshet Yamin Te'aseh Melacha. 6 days your work should be done. U'bayom HaShevi'i Yehyeh Lachem Kodesh. And on the seventh day it'll be holy. Shabbat Shabbaton Hashem. It's a day of stoppage of work for God. Kol Ha'oseh Bo Melacha Yumat. Anybody that does work on the Shabbat will be put to death. The Hatam Sofer has a nice idea. What does the Torah mean when it says, Sheshet Yamim Te'aseh Melacha? 6 days, your work should be done for you, and then on the seventh day, you should rest. Hatam Sofer explains that the Torah is giving you a piece of advice for a businessman that has a store, or for a merchant that has his operations opened on Shabbat. What can inspire him to close? After all, Shabbat, generally speaking, is the biggest day of the week. How could a person be willing to sacrifice and give up all those profits, especially all his hard work that he put into opening a store? Now you're going to tell him the busiest day of the week to close it? So the Torah reminds a person that even the 6 days that you're working, it's not you. You can only make that mistake of getting fooled into opening up on Shabbat if you think, well, listen, you know, I'm doing things 6 days a week and I'm providing and I'm bringing and I'm doing and I'm buying and I'm selling. And therefore, if I don't continue what I'm doing, the Shabbat, I'm going to lose my business. So the Torah is very careful in its language. It doesn't say, Sheshet Yamim Ta'aseh Melacha. If the word would be ta'aseh means physically you go work for 6 days. But the Torah, just with a change of punctuation, says te'aseh. What is the what does the te'aseh do? That's the Torah's way of saying 6 days your work should be done. As if to say that it'll be done by a divine source. It'll be done by itself. Yes, you have to go to work. Yes, you have to make an effort. Yes, you have to try. Yes, you have to be diligent. Yes, you have to be aggressive. But at the end of the day, with all the hishtadlut and all the effort, it's not your work. It's te'aseh. It is done automatically. And the proof of the pudding is, you'll see two people that have the exact same store, and the stores are right next to each other, and they have the same diligence, and they have the same commitment, and they have the same hours, and they have the same merchandise. For some reason, one person is very successful and becomes a wealthy man, and the other person is going out of business. And what happened? If there's a simple equation of hard work brings return, so both of them should have equal amount. And the explanation is that it's te'aseh melacha. That ultimately the profits and the rewards of your work is from God. Now, if a person has that attitude, that it's te'aseh and not ta'aseh, then it's easy for him to close on Shabbat. Because it wasn't you the 6 days anyway, so what's the difference? A person that gets fooled and thinks that it's him, so he can say, if it's me, so I can't do it. But if anyway all this was a charade, if all you're going to work and buying and selling and all doing that, if anyway it was God from above that was maneuvering and bringing you your parnasah, so the Torah tells you, Sheshet yamim te'aseh menachah, if you have the attitude of te'aseh menachah, then ubayom ha-shivi'i elachem kodesh. Then it'll be easy for the seventh day to be kodesh. Now, sometimes even that won't sink through a person. Because when a person hears dollars, and a person, you talk about his pocket, so you can speak to him very logically. And you can tell him, it's not you, it's God, he doesn't want to hear that. You know, you can't tell somebody, you know, a whole religious dialogue, and a whole speech, and a whole schmooze. The bottom line, Rabbi, you tell me to close. That's the bottom line. The bottom line, it's money. He can show you the report. Yeah, on Saturday, I make, you know, 30% to 50% of my business is on sale. So all your hadushim, all your ideas. So the Torah knows that guy also. So therefore, at the end, the Torah writes, there's only one way you can speak to that fellow. Kol ha'oseh bo melacha yumat. Then the Torah has to come along with its tactics. The Torah has to come along and say, oh, by the way, if you didn't get sold on that, incidentally, whoever does work on Shabbat, bar minan yumat. The punishment is, it's a death sentence. So that already can sober up even the most aggressive businessman that has such a desire and he's salivating for money, but when he hears the consequence of such an act, so then he'll go make his proper adjustments in order to make his business clean on Shabbat. The Hafetz Chaim had a different understanding of this pasuk. The Hafetz Chaim was once in a city of Chernikov in Russia. And he saw a Jew there, and the Jew was opened on Shabbat. So the Hafiz Chaim went to the fellow to try to impress upon him the importance of closing on Shabbat. So what did he tell him? He said, I want to explain to you Pasuk in the Torah. If the Torah wanted to teach the Jews to keep Shabbat, what does it have to preface it by saying, Sheshet yamim ta'aseh menachah, 6 days go to work, and then on the seventh day, take off. What's the difference of 6 days going to work? The Torah's not telling you have to go to work for 6 days. The point is, you have to take off on the seventh day. So therefore, why preface it with Sheshet yamim ta'aseh menachah? That's not the main part of the story. The main part of the story is the seventh day. We don't care what you do on the 6 days. You want to golf for 6 days? You want to sleep for 6 days? That's not the point. The point is the seventh day. So the Hafetz Chaim is telling you like this. So what I was saying, if you want business 6 days a week, make sure the seventh day you keep a Shabbat. Because if you don't keep day number seven, then God will see to it that the 6 days, which are primarily work days, there will be no work for you. And he was hinting to this, he was clearly hitting this guy over the head and said, you think you have a big factory? He says, but if you want to have business 6 days a week, you better close Shabbat. And the fellow answered sarcastically. He was a cynic. He said, you're telling me my whole business is going to hinge on the interpretation of a pasuk in the Bible? And he laughed, and he mocked the Hafetz Chaim. The Hafetz Chaim walked away. Shortly thereafter, the communists came in and took over Russia, and they seized a lot of property, and they seized a lot of businesses, and one of the factories that were taken over by the government was this fellow's factory. And overnight, he went from being a well-to-do man, a wealthy person, and to becoming destitute, to having nothing. And he wrote a letter to the Hafetz Chaim. And he said, my dear Rabbi, you taught me a lesson. My factory indeed is based on an interpretation from one pasuk in the Torah. Sheshet yamim te'aseh melacha. If you want to have work for 6 days, then ubayom ha-shivi'i, Shabbat, Lashem, that on the seventh day, yeh lachem kodesh. We don't know that. We don't know that. We don't know that. You're not arguing with what I'm saying. I don't believe you're arguing with what I'm saying. You're not telling everybody over there they should work on Shabbat. No, you agree with what I'm saying. You just don't like that story. I'm telling you, you just don't like that by choice of stories, but you're agreeing with the concept. Right, you don't agree with working on Shabbat. I never professed that I'm the best storyteller, by the way. I've been told that before, that I don't know how to tell a story, or you don't like it. I have no problem. I don't take it personal. Sorry, which I tell you. Now, it's okay. It's a free country. It's my pleasure. I made the wrong announcement. I said, don't solicit. I should have said, don't interrupt. That's worse than that. The Torah says over here, in the next pasuk, Lo teva'aru esh b'chol moshbotechem b'yom ha-Shabbat. What does that mean? Do not light a fire in all your domain on Shabbat. Now all the rabbis are bothered with this pasuk, because we know that lighting a fire is only one of many things that are forbidden on Shabbat. As a matter of fact, there are 39 primary midachot that are forbidden on Shabbat. So why would the Torah single out making a fire? How come it didn't say, don't plow, don't write, don't erase, don't tan leather, don't dye garments, don't wash clothes, don't squeeze? I mean, there's a million things you can't do. The Torah goes out of its way and says, so I saw a few explanations. One explanation they say is, we may read this pasuk and understand it a little out of its natural context. When a person gets angry, when a person is filled with rage, many times you see his face turn red. We have a statement that we say, when people get angry, his blood was boiling. The Torah is coming to tell us over here, Lo teva'aru esh b'chol moshbotechem. Do not ignite a fire. This is referring to anger. Do not boil your blood. Do not become enraged in all of your domain on Shabbat. Why would the Torah have to say that? Because we have a tradition that says, on Friday afternoon, right before Shabbat, especially in the winter when the time is short, but this applies all year round, the hour before, and as you get closer to Shabbat, it gets more severe, the Satan, knowing how valuable Shabbat is, and knowing the importance and the benefits that one can have from a positive Shabbat, he tries to come up it. He tries to put a damper on the whole Shabbat. And therefore he engineers situations that happen, things that don't happen all week, all of a sudden start to happen 20 minutes before Shabbat. All of a sudden a pipe breaks right before Shabbat. Or all of a sudden that you realize you didn't pick up the cleaners. All of a sudden, you know, the oven breaks. Or the things that will never happen, but somehow always 20 minutes before Shabbat, these things always seem to happen. And people are nervous, and they get in the shower, and get out of the shower, and then you're not dressed yet, and where's my this, and where's my that, and you didn't buy this, and that. It becomes a little hectic time. And what happens is, words are said, and people are in their hype, they get excited, and then people get offended, and because of the anger, what happens is, a Friday night meal already is destroyed. Because everybody's angry. You said this to me, you did that to me, you didn't do this, you went, and the whole Shabbat already starts with on the wrong foot. So the Torah's warning you, Lo teva'aru esh b'chol moshbotechem b'yom ha-Shabbat. You have to see to it to put out all fires, internal fires, when it comes to the Shabbat. But you can't do that on Shabbat. This has to be already prepared from Erev Shabbat. If I gave you the trick now. Know you're being set up. It's a setup. The Satan is not doing it in your house only. He does it in my house. He does it in his. Everybody's house is the same thing happening. Smart are the people that know the rules of the Satan, and they know his schemes, and they say, go somewhere else, you're not going to bother me. That's why we have a Mishnah. The Mishnah writes, Shilosha devarim sarich adam lomar betoch beto erev Shabbat im hashecha. There are three things that a person has to say in his house, Erev Shabbat, close to sunset. Esarten, Arabten, Hadlika with Tanir. What are these three things? The husband asks his wife, did you Esarten, did you prepare the food? Is the food okay? Everything's ready? Arabten, did you prepare the Eruv? Is the Eruv up? Is everything okay with the, so we can carry, etc.? And the last one is Hadlika with Tanir. Hadlika with Tanir means, okay, it's time, light the candles. So one of my rabbis once asked me, he said, every word in the Mishnah, or for that matter in any Mishnah, is precise. There's no extra words. And if there are seemingly extra words, there's a lesson to be learned. So he asked me, he said, what does it mean, Shiloshad devarim sarich adam lomar betoch beto? He has to say three things in his house. Of course he's in his house. If he's talking to his wife and telling her to light candles and prepare the food, where is he talking? In his neighbor's house? Why would the Mishnah have to say something superfluous? It's obvious if you're talking to your wife, it's in your house. Why would the Mishnah go out of its way to say, betoch beto? So I answered my rabbi, and I said that the Torah is coming to teach a person that Erev Shabbat, since it's hectic, so the nature of a person is to start screaming. Well, you didn't prepare the food, you didn't... And sometimes a person will scream so loud that the voice does not remain betoch beto. It's not in his home anymore. Already the neighbors can hear what's going on. Already the people on the street, what's going on in their house over here? Bedlam, helter skelter, what's going on? Everyone's going crazy. So therefore the Torah comes along and says, Shiloshadim sikhwat betoch beto. They're telling the husband, keep it low. Make sure you don't lose your cool. Lo teva'aru esh, bechol moshmotechem b'yom ha-shabbat. Another explanation, again, out of context. The soul, the neshama, is compared to a flame, to a fire. The Torah might be telling us, although Shabbat is a great day of inspiration where we all feel spiritually uplifted, where the soul is burning and the soul is elevating itself, and the fire of the neshama is ignited. But what about the rest of the week? You know, to become only inspired and motivated and spiritually uplifted once a week is quite praiseworthy, but it's not enough. And therefore the Torah is telling you, Moshe was admonishing the people, Lo teva'aru esh, do not ignite the fire of your soul b'yom ha-shabbat, only on Shabbat. One must be spiritually cognizant of growth the other 6 days of the week also. Shabbat, maybe a little more than the other days because you have free time and you have time to concentrate on religion. But that is not to say you should neglect the neshama, the soul, the other days of the week. The Torah then discusses the subject of the Mishkan. Now, when it comes to the subject of the Mishkan, we find something that the Torah, it stands out. Donations were needed to build the Mishkan. The men donated money, the ladies donated money. But from the Pesukim, when you look in the Pesukim, and the Nashi brings it down several times, it seems that the ladies were a little more excited in giving money for the Mishkan, even more than the men. And the Torah points it out. And we have to understand why were the ladies, or why were their donations more accepted? Why did they have the primary position in donating money for the Mishkan? The Torah is coming to tell us a lesson here. You remember last week when Aharon asked for some gold? So he said, we need to build an egel, so we need gold. So go to your wives and ask them for their golden earrings for their egel. And we know that the lady said, nothing doing, we're not giving you our earrings. And we praise the ladies for that. So look at the righteous ladies, they didn't want to give up their gold for an egel. But the question is, why is that so praiseworthy? maybe the reason why they didn't give up the gold is not because they didn't want to build an egel, but you know, they didn't want to give up their jewelry. You know, they were ladies. The egel's a great idea, but you know, not my jewelry. You know, I'm with you, but not don't take my earrings. So how do we know that? And God rewarded them, we learned. God said, because you didn't give your gold, God gave them Rosh Chodesh. Halakha brings down that some ladies have a custom not to work on Rosh Chodesh. They take the day off. They don't do laundry. They don't do hard labor, etc. So you see, the ladies did get rewarded. So the rabbis want to know, but who said that the intent was so good? It is in this week's parasha that you see, when it came to making donations for the Mishkan, who was giving all their jewelry and all their money? The ladies. So you see over here, it wasn't a motivation of they wanted to hold on to their jewelry. Because when the right project came, it was the ladies that were willing to give their jewelry. On the contrary, they were happy, they were even more excited than the men. So the Torah writes it down in this parasha, so you know the intent retroactively that they had in last week's parasha. Don't think it was coming last because they were being frugal with their jewelry. On the contrary, this week's parasha, they threw the money to Moshe Rabbeinu to show you that the ladies were, again, the driving force behind the building of the Mishkan. Also, we may point out that the Mishkan must be constructed from pure materials. The gold of the men might have been tainted already. Because there is a law that says if somebody designates gold for Avodah Zarah, says, I'm going to take this gold over here and one day I'm going to build a statue. So this gold already becomes forbidden to use for God now. Even though you didn't do anything with it, you just designated it because it's not kavod. You're going to take gold that you designated for foreign gods and now you're going to use that gold to build a house for Hashem? So when it came to the men, a lot of their gold was tainted because they got involved with Egel. So who knows, you know, the money that they designated, the money that they melted down. So therefore, their money was dirty money. But Moshe Rabbeinu knew he could rely on the ladies because they didn't have a hand in the Egel. The gold that came from the ladies was pure. They told their husbands last week, we want to have nothing to do with this Egel. You guys are getting involved in a mess over here. Keep us out of it. So when Moshe Rabbeinu took that gold he knew was tahor. It was pure. So again, the ladies see the level of importance that they had when it came to this structure. It's not the first time in the Torah that you see this. Again, I want to point out our Torah is neither prejudiced nor biased against ladies. Although some of the modern feminists get a little upset because the Torah doesn't mention a lady's name in every single pasuk, but then you can never make them happy. The Torah, in many cases, for example, when Sarah Imenu saw Yishmael, Avraham's son, playing with her son, Yitzhak. Avraham thought it was innocent. Kids playing, it's nice, it's cute. But Sarah saw in that playing destruction. He saw negative influences. And Sarah told Avraham, Abinu, you got to throw the guy out. He's a bum. Get rid of him. And Avraham says, what are you talking about? Azit, the playing, there's nothing wrong with it. It's innocent, it's pav, it's kosher. And God told Avraham, you blew it. Sarah's right. Listen to her. She has intuition. She's seeing things you don't see. So again, when we look back at the beginning of our people, you know, Yitzhak only remains pure as he was and worthy to sit on the Mizbeach, not because of Avraham. If it was up to Avraham, Yishmael would have tainted the Yitzhak and he would have lost his purity. It's against Sarah, a lady, that is the driving force again, behind the Avot. Rivka and Yitzhak is the same way. If it was up to Yitzhak, he would have gave Esav the blessing. Esav's the gangster, Esav's the bum, he's the derelict child. Yitzhak didn't see it for whatever reason. Rivka saw it. So again, you see, if it's not for Rivka, so then who knows? Yaakov Abinu doesn't have that same position again. Go into Egypt even. Amram we learned in this class, divorced his wife. He felt that it wasn't the proper thing to be married in Egypt. Why bring children to be born to one day become slaves? Better we divorce and don't bring children into such an unstable world. And who rebuked Amram?
Miriam.
Very good. Miriam. Miriam said, "Dad, you're making a mistake. You're wrong. You're worse than Paro." And she gave him a whole speech. And as a result of that, Amram remarried his wife. And the rest is history. Who was born a few months later? Moshe Rabbeinu. So you see again, it was the lady's advice that inspired the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu. Goes without saying, the midwives in Egypt, the Mialedot, if it's not for those midwives that did not kill the Jewish boys, we don't have a people. So the perpetuation of our nation, the existence of our nation, is in the hands of ladies. So again, when we read the story about the Mishkan, which was one of the holiest edifices created, the ladies have to know this was not solely a man's project. It can be said that the ladies had equal, if not more, influence on the construction of this Mishkan. That being said, the Torah does tell us specifically in Perek Lamed He, Pasuk Bet, Pasuk Chaf Bet, Vayavohu ha'anashim al hanashim. The men came with the woman, they came together, Kol nediv lev, all the generous ones, obviously, and they brought all their donations. Our rabbis all ask, what do you mean, men and ladies coming together over here to give the donations? It's a funny thing, the men came, and all the ladies came along. So some explain, because we have a halakha from the Gemara. Is a lady allowed to give charity without her husband's permission? The Gemara says no. Gemara says that a lady gives charity, especially a significant amount, so therefore needs the permission of the husband. If the money's coming from the husband, the money was given, allotted for whatever it was, for necessities in the home, etc. But to give money now, to give the husband's money to charity, let's say. Unless she has private money from before she was married, she has a trust fund somewhere, that's some money that no one, that the husband has nothing to do with, even that's questionable after she gets married. So therefore it says the ladies had to come with the men to show Moshe Rabbeinu that they got permission. And all of a sudden she's giving all her jewelry. Moshe Rabbeinu says, I don't know if I can take this over here. So the man was standing right there, no, I gave the permission, he can take it. Hence the men had to come with the ladies in this case over here. Now one of the things that the Torah tells us after this whole meeting that Moshe Rabbeinu had, teaching them the laws of Shabbat and discussing some Mishkan related issues, it says after the meeting was over, Vayetze'u kol adat b'nei Yisrael melefne Moshe. So then all the Jewish people, they left, they exited from in front of Moshe. Now again, there are no extra letters in our Torah or words. The Torah told us already, who called this meeting? Moshe. So if you're leaving the meeting, you're obviously leaving a meeting in front of Moshe. Why couldn't the Torah just say, Vayetze'u kol adat b'nei Yisrael? They left. We know where they left. You told me where they were. Isn't it obvious that they left from in front of Moshe? Moshe was giving them the class. What does it mean they left from in front of Moshe? Eliyahu Lopyan gives a very important word of Musar in this Pasuk, and we have to teach it to our children. He says, when you see a person walking in the street, just by the way he's walking and his disposition, many times you can tell where this person just came from. You see a person walking in the street and he's wobbling and he's, you know, two steps forward, then he makes Oshe Shalom, he makes three steps back, and he's, you know, he's not stable. So you know he's coming from a bar. You know he's drunk. You know he's coming from from drinking. When you see somebody running in the street and he's all pumped up and he's jumping and he's punching in the air and he's going and he's like, so he's just coming from the gym. He's just coming from playing ball. So you see he's excited. He has still a lot of energy. So he said, when somebody leaves a Torah class, or somebody leaves the yeshiva, or somebody leaves the synagogue, it should be evident by your actions after you left that everybody will know this person must have just been learning Torah. Which means a person that leaves a Torah class must have changed. Something had to be absorbed. Something had to be permeated in his system. He cannot be the same person. But God forbid, if a student comes out of the yeshiva, and he's rowdy, and he's loud in the street, and the goyim come along and say, or the non-religious people say, what is the animals? Where are they coming from? They're coming from a zoo! Then already, the whole Torah and the whole education system becomes it looks like a mockery in the eyes of the people. And therefore, you have to be careful to behave, not only in the class, but more important, when you leave the class, everybody should say, look at those fine yeshiva boys. Look at those fine behaved, well behaved. They must teach them that in school. They must teach them how to talk, how to act. So the Pasuk says like this, Vayetze'u kol adat b'nei Yisrael. All the Jewish people left that meeting, Milifne Moshe. But it was evident after they left, that if you saw them, you would have said, oh, these people were just in front of Moshe. Even after they left, even after Vayetze'u, it was clear that they were just Milifne Moshe, that they were just in front of Moshe Rabbeinu. Hence the Torah is telling you, in front of the rabbi you have to have that awe, and when you leave also, that awe should still be on your face. It should be clear that you're also coming from Torah. Torah then lists some of the pieces of furniture. Furniture is a bad word. The furnishings of the Mishkan, it's more than furnishings. These were holy vessels. The most important vessel in the Mishkan was the Aron. Was the Ark. In the Ark you had the Luchot, the tablets. We learned this, the two tablets, the broken tablets were in there also. You had in it a Sefer Torah. You had in it some pieces of man that were placed for the archives. Holy thing, the Aron. And on top of the Aron, you had Kerubim. I want to discuss the Kerubim for a second. The Kerubim, in English, they call them the cherubs. What was it? It was a golden structure. One piece. And it came curving over each other with wings on the side of it and the faces of two children looking at each other. Wasn't an easy thing to create, obviously, but the Torah tells us who made the Aron, who was in charge of that. So the Torah says, Vaya'az Besal'el et Aron. Besal'el made the Aron, which means everything else, it was a partnership. Other people were involved in building it. It wasn't a one-man show. But when it came to the Aron, Bezalel did it alone. The question is why. So I saw an explanation. The Meshech Chochmah says, the Kerubim, these cherubs, this golden image that was in the Holy of Holies, it doesn't sound like such a Jewish item. I mean, the Torah does tell us clearly, do not make for me silver images and sculptures. I mean, it's a funny thing. The Gemara in Yomah tells us when the Goyim came to destroy the Beit HaMikdash, when they went into the Holy of Holies and they saw the Kerubim, they were shocked. They said, what? This is what the Jewish people, the Holy of Holies, they have this structure, they have this this image of gold. It sounded un-Jewish to the non-Jews. So we're forced to explain that the only reason why you're allowed to have Kerubim is because God sanctioned it. And if God doesn't sanction it, then it's like the Egel. You know, the Egel is a beautiful gold structure, but God didn't sanction that. God didn't allow it. The problem is now, you're dealing with a kerubin that's a borderline item. If you have the right kavana, 100% pure intention, it's a great item. But God forbid, if you're building those kerubim, and in your mind, you're thinking, maybe they have power of themselves, maybe it's an idol. Even if it just crosses through your mind, you know, the Mishkan is such a sensitive structure that the thoughts in the architect, what he was thinking when he was building, affected the Mishkan. You know, it's not like today somebody's building a house. You have Puerto Ricans listening to rap music when they're building the house, and he's thinking about all the perversions of the world when he's banging on the beams. So therefore, they were not talking about that. We're talking about over here. These men, when they were building the Mishkan, they were thinking of the most lofty, highest ideas, and they had to concentrate. It was like Ne'ilah on Kippur. There was no talking. What do you think? They were building the Mishkan and they were talking with each other, telling each other jokes and sketching around? Of course not. It was done with seriousness. Mikveh and Tahara. God was concerned if anybody else would get involved in building the Aron but Bitzal'el, they already became tainted from the Egel. Once already there was an egel in the world, it will cross anybody's mind, any human being's mind, it's going to cross that what? Man, it's like a form of an egel. Who knows? It's gold. Looks like the egel. It's gold like the egel. It's going to be compromised. And if it's compromised, God forbid, the kirubim that are a great thing can turn into a disaster. But there's one man that God was certain that had no trace of any fallout of the egel in him. And that was Bezalel. Because the Torah tells us, who was Bezalel's grandfather?
Hur.
Very good, Hur. And we learned last week that Bezalel's grandfather was so anti-Egel, and he couldn't stand the Egel so much that he died as a result of it. He told the Jewish people, you're not allowed to do the Egel. They said, well, if you don't let us do it, we're going to kill you. And Hur said, you know what? Kill me. It's disgusting. Haram to do the Egel. And they killed him. So if there's any family that had such a, they were repulsed, that had such a disgust towards Egel, it's Hur's family. And there's no question that feeling of the vile sin of the Egel was passed down to his grandson. Now that family was definitely the most extreme, who was there at the time of Egel, that had nothing to do with it. I mean, they told stories around the table that grandpa died because of the Egel. So Bezalel was certain not to have any thoughts, God forbid, that might compromise the Kirubim. Hence, he was the one alone to make the Aron and all its pieces. Incidentally, the Kirubim rested on top of the Aron. Lastly, I just saw on the way here from Rav Shimon Schwab, he said a nice point. Most of us heard of Bezalel, but Bezalel actually had a partner in his work. A fellow by the name of Aholiav ben Ahisamach from the tribe of Dan. So Rav Shimon Schwab points out, we know so much about Bezalel, and we know so little about Aholiab ben Ahisamach. Bezalel is a man that comes from the tribe of Yehuda, the best of the tribes. His grandfather's Hur, who's a great rabbi. He possessed the wisdom of God. His name itself, Bezalel, is Bezalel. He's in the shadow of God when it comes to wisdom. He was able to create the world himself, the Gemara tells us. And Aholiab ben Ahisamach doesn't tell us who his family is. We don't know who Ahisamach is. We don't know who his grandfather is. On the contrary, it says he's from the tribe of Dan. And we know Dan was from the lowest of the tribes. If you had to number the tribes, Dan is the last tribe. Says the rabbi, the Torah is coming to teach you that the Mishkan was an equal opportunity institution. The Mishkan did not only serve the super righteous and the super lineage and the super genius. The Mishkan served also the Aholi Av ben Ahisamach, the regular guy, doesn't come from the best tribe, doesn't have the best family, he doesn't have the best recognition in the world. But the Mishkan is created to serve that person also. And the lesson being for us, Torah and the study of Torah and synagogues and etc. are not only for the elite. On the contrary, Torah does not believe in that. Our Torah believes that it is equal access. Everybody has a right to sit and learn. Nobody should think, well, you know, I'm not as religious as the next one, so this is not for me. The Torah went out of its way to show you the contrast. Bezalel over here on top, and all the other partners building the Mishkan. What do you have to do with me? You're a regular guy, I'm a big tzaddik. But the Torah is telling you, both of them partnered up to build the Mishkan, to teach you the Mishkan is created to serve both, and both have equal rights. And no person should ever feel that he's a second-class citizen, or he's beneath somebody else because he might not be as hashuv or as important or as smart or even yet as religious. Nobody should think in such terms, because God doesn't think in those terms. God does not think in terms more religious means automatically you're preferential and you're better, and the people that didn't reach that level yet are considered second class. Although sometimes people might give us that feeling. But I'm telling you, God doesn't have that feeling. Sometimes people on their road to growth, they're innocent. Trust me, they're innocent. On their road to growth, it's new to them also. So therefore, sometimes they send off the wrong vibes to others, and others might feel very small in front of such people. I'll say myself, I never felt small in front of the great rabbis that I was with, because they were great rabbis. I never felt small. On the contrary, in front of the greatest rabbis, when we were young kids walking around, joking around, we weren't yet learning yet, but we always walked away feeling, from our rabbis, feeling big. We felt feeling great, we felt was with tzaddikim. And it's because our rabbis that were towering over us, gave us that feeling of we were towering over them, or that we were worthy. So that gave us the motivation to become worthy. And therefore, we tell specific ladies in this class, God appreciates your level, whatever the level may be, whether it's the level of Bezalel, or whether it's the level of Aholi Av ben Ahisamach, but both, in God's eyes, have an equality in order to build the Mishkan, which purposes to bring the Shekhinah down. Both have the ability to please God. Of course, it's our wish and our hope, and talking to myself, to aspire to the highest levels. But even before we reach those levels, nobody should feel that, Chas v'Shalom, God is upset with them, or God has claims against them. So long as he sees a progression, so long as he sees a movement, in God's book, there's no such thing as second-class citizens. God doesn't look down. God does not have the attitude of holier than thou, even though he is the holiest than thou, than in the world. But God does not emanate those feelings. This is the lesson of the partnership of Aholi Av and Bezalel.